Welcome to Ink in Your Veins. I'm your host, Rachel Herron. In this podcast, I talk to authors about the best things they've learned about writing so we can try those things too. I'll keep each episode short so you can get back to writing. Well, hello, writers. Welcome to episode number 417 of Ink in Your Veins. I almost said the old podcast name. I'm Rachel Herron. So thrilled that you're here today as I am doing a mini episode bumper crop of questions that have been piling up. And I mentioned this last week, but I did most of this episode and forgot to hit record, which is not usually a problem because I have automatic recording sessions. And I just went into the wrong recording session, which was not recording. So then I was tired and needed to regroup because I had some great answers. So hopefully today I'm going to be equally as or even more smart than I was that day. So here we go into these questions. And as a reminder, these questions are brought to you, the entire podcast, from my Patreon supporters over at patreon.com/Rachel, R-A-C-H-A-E-L. You can support me for $5 a month or more if you would like. And then I am your coach. I am your mini coach. What you have noticed by listening to this podcast is my answers are not always swift because sometimes I do a show and then questions start piling up and I hold questions until I have a bunch of them to answer. So I'm not the kind of coach to go to if you need to find out what to do tomorrow. Definitely, I would be the worst at that because I'm terrible at email. I'm terrible at text. I'm terrible at returning things. However, I am reliable in that I always do it eventually, always. And if anyone has ever asked me a question that I didn't answer, please hit me up because sometimes Patreon will hide some of the questions, but I am pretty good at now at going in and looking for them too. And I really love doing this. This is part of one of my favorite things to do as a working writer is to share what I've learned so that perhaps you don't have to make all the same silly mistakes that I have made over the years. And I so enjoy doing this, and I so appreciate you patrons who are over there at patreon.com. You can join for $1 a month and get all of the essays. You can get so many things over at patreon.com. So patreon.com/Rachel. I'd love your support. And let's jump into the questions now. All right. So this one is from Caitlin, who says, I really do have a situation brewing here. I have a pretty clear idea of my plot and have since 2020. The more I am focusing on these characters and the actual story, the more I'm seeing a departure from the plan. At this point, I am just going to write forward and see how it plays out, but the revision is going to be a bear. How do I keep myself from getting too overwhelmed to even finish the first draft? And then, holy crap, I don't even know where to begin after that, but I'll cross that bridge when I get there. Such a normal feeling. This is normal. And this is also one of the biggest danger points for a writer is when we are getting ready to write or we have been writing, but we get nervous about where we're going next and we slow down and stop to think. Stopping to think is part of our jobs. Some of us have to think more and longer than others. Some people are just natural whiz kids. When they go to the page, all the ideas fall out of their fingertips onto the keyboard. Some of us need more time. I'm one of the more time kind of writers. So thinking is part of this. However, we have to put time boxes. We have to put limitations around the thinking we do. And then we have to write and we have to write a crappy first draft. Because if we don't, then we stop for a day to think. And the next day we're kind of busy. So we're going to do some more thinking about this book on the weekend, but then the weekend passes by. And then we do a little bit of work, but we need to do some more thinking. So we're going to think about that tomorrow. And it doesn't happen the next weekend because we're busy. And it doesn't happen the next month because it's just been pretty stressful. And you see where this is going. We end up a year later and we realize, yeah, every day I have meant to write my book. And every day I have not been working on it because I'm always waiting to have the final ideas that I know will make the book work. It's a fallacy. That is a lie. Your brain is telling you that is untrue. It is almost impossible. I won't say impossible because nothing's impossible, but for us mere mortals, it is impossible to wait until we know how a book should go, how it should be written. But none of us ever say, I give up. I'm not going to write this book. We don't say that. We say, I'm going to work on it on the weekend. And when we say, I want you all to listen to this if you are not writing right now. When we say, I'm going to work on it tomorrow, or I'm going to work on it on the weekend, what we are saying is, I give up. I'm not going to write this book. And if your heart just plunged into your stomach at me saying that, and Caitlin, I am not talking to you now, I am talking to everybody. If your heart just leapt into the puddle at your feet, because you know that's you, then the good news is there's a very, very simple solution. You write a little bit today. And sometimes when I say that, our lives are prohibitive. You may have 4 kids and you're ill. Okay, you're not going to write today, but you are going to write tomorrow for 5 minutes. You are going to plan. You're going to get out your calendar. And this is so huge for so many people, even though we think we don't need to. Just try this. If you don't do this, look at whatever calendar keeping method you use and put onto the calendar the next week's worth of writing. You might be able to find 4 15-minute slots. Put them in and try to hit them. And then you go, you show up and you do crappy work without the clarity that you think you need. You write a terrible first draft, and then the revision is a bear. Just like you said, Caitlin, I am worried that the revision is going to be a bear. It will be. Revision is always a bear. A revision is a bear for people who are excellent plotters, who have every scene mapped out and dialed in. Revision is still a huge, awful, gnarly beast. And it is quite a, this can be sometimes even a bigger beast if you are a pantser and you wing your way through the whole first draft. But it doesn't matter, because revision is at its base a thing that we can do with a set of tools. You can learn a set of tools. You can go Google Rachel Herron revision and a ton of tools will come up, including a couple of these podcasts where I break it down for you the way I do it. Or join my email newsletter, rachelherron.com/write. And in somewhere in that autoresponder sequence, you will get an hour and a half course of exactly how I teach revision. So that is that should roll over to your desk right now, rachelherron.com/write. Get on that. If you have any questions about revision tools, I give you an entire hour and a half class that I gave for another group, and it gives you all the tools. And the nice thing about revision is it is a set of tools you pick up, you make them your own, and you do the work. First drafts are, who knows how to write those? That is where we get stuck. We say, I'll think about it. I'll figure it out tomorrow. And that means I give up. I'm never going to do this. And we refuse to let that happen. You are listening to this podcast because you are not a writer who will let that happen. Most writers do this on accident. They don't know what's happening to them. But now that I've kind of maybe pulled back the curtain on that and showed you that perhaps that is what you are doing, you won't. You'll be so mad at me for saying it that you will write today or tomorrow, preferably today, even if it's for 5 minutes. And then in a year, you're going to write to me and say, Rachel, I want on your podcast because I did it. I am a writer who is writing and finishing books. So I would love that to happen to all of you. So do remember to take it one step at a time. Don't worry about the revision yet. Don't worry about anything but getting some crappy words on the page. And when I mean crappy. Leave gaps, leave sentences hanging, leave nouns out. If you can't think of the right noun, just leave a big TK or an asterisk or something that will flag to you later. I'm going to think of a noun. I'm going to think of a good noun. Ooh, I'm going to think of an even better verb. Just do a little bit of crappy writing. Please, please don't fall into that danger zone of not writing the book that you need to write. Thank you so much for asking that. All right. And then here is Rachel. Rachel's got some difficult, awesome questions. And I asked Rachel's permission to read these on the podcast because these were actually just an email to me, but I think that they are so important. I wanted to talk about them here. So Rachel says, at this point, I have queried 82 agents. Those who responded were all very kind, but it's been all rejections. I hired an editor back in October, and I am now working on making all those edits. He also revamped my query letters. His changes on both were very minimal, though, and I was hoping that it would be a lot more fixes so that I could maybe understand why it's being rejected. My husband continues to say that I will never publish a memoir, and I need to give it up. I have an Excel chart with all the agents that I could find that will accept memoirs, and there's about 100 left. I'm willing to query all of them. If you think that I might have any kind of chance, please be honest. Self-publishing is super expensive, and honestly, I am so overwhelmed at all the things that need to be done. And I don't know the first thing about marketing or distributing my books. I've had a few people read it now, and they all said it really needs to be out there. I know it's good writing. I've had a few hybrid publishers reach out to me and was wondering what your thoughts on them are. Would I be really stupid to pay $1,600 to $4,000 on hiring a one-stop shop publisher and they take over the work from here? They will also market and distribute the books for me, and the royalties are better than traditional publishing. Convincing my husband to let me spend the money is another matter, but I'll cross that bridge when I have to. Just thought I'd ask. Let's see. There's more questions, but I'm going to start with these questions. Because there's a bunch of things I want to say to every line in here. Number one, I'm so proud of you that you finished the memoir, and I'm so proud of you that you have been editing it. Also, I have to admit that I'm going to express a little bit of anger here at a couple of people, and you, Rachel, are not one of them. I'm angry at this editor. You say his changes on both my manuscript and my query letter were very minimal. Editors shouldn't be suggesting changes that are minimal. What we're hoping when we hire a developmental editor, which I assume this was, is that they will have that big overarching look from above, high above, and say, this part of the book is not as well paced as it needs to be. Here are some ways you could rev up the pace or slow down the pace if it's moving too fast. And they need to say, this is where the character arc development is not believable. And this whole section doesn't fit here. Do you need it at all? Let's talk about that. We want editors to make incredibly scary suggestions when we hire them, not minor fixes on the page that are on the line edit or the copy edit level. We love a line edit. We love somebody telling us how to make a sentence stronger. But an editor, a developmental editor, should really be telling us how to tear our books apart and put them back together again. We do that on our own. We write a book. We revise a book as much as we can by tearing it apart and putting it back together as much as we can on our own. And then we all need developmental editors, whether we hire them out of our own pocket, which is what you did, or we go out and get an agent, try to get an agent who will then sometimes act as your first developmental editor and hopefully sell your book to an editor at a publishing house, a traditional publishing house, who will then be your next developmental editor. And we're looking for those big changes for them. So I am sorry that he made minimal changes. That wouldn't make me feel confident either. I would worry that he hadn't seen what I am not seeing and need somebody else to see. So that's a bummer. But I have seen your work, and your work is beautiful. We have worked together, Rachel and I have. And I know your writing, and I know your story, and I know that this book is a book that will change lives when people read it. And that leads me into my second statement that I'm mad at your stupid husband. Excuse me. You don't have to play this for him. Although, you know, I don't care if he hates me. Go ahead and do it if you want to. Your husband continues to say that you will never publish a memoir and you need to give it up. I would immediately try to publish 4 memoirs and I would make a pillow out of them and put that on his side of the bed and say, you don't get a pillow until you sleep on my 4 to 17 memoirs that I am now publishing just to show you. I think that that is incredibly unhelpful and not supportive. And I'm not saying you need to leave him in the dust, far from that, but I am saying he cannot be a source of support in your writing anymore. And I would encourage you not to talk about it with him at all, if possible. And I don't know how that'll work in your relationship. I don't know what that means in terms of childcare and division of labor and time. And this is something that perhaps you will have to say, look, I can't do that right now because I actually need that hour to write. So that may come up again. But if you can hear anything in your voice, if he says anything minimizing like that to you again, please hear my voice that says you are worthy of writing this book and publishing this book. In whatever way that looks like, whether it goes traditional route or self-publishing, this book deserves to be out in the world. Your voice deserves to be heard. And I know that you probably can't be as mad at your husband as you want to be or whatever, but I can because I don't know the man. So I'm sorry that that happened to you, and it's not okay, and you deserve to be supported. And so he can't be a support for that. He's perhaps a lovely support in many other ways, but you need other support systems. Where are your other writer friends? Are they online? Can you find them online? Can you make them in person? Any writer friend will be the perfect support for you. Well, as long as you vet them and you have decided that they will be your friend and you spend some time over coffee and writing together in cafes, whatever that looks like. But you need somebody to go to say these things to, who will say, screw that, keep going. Screw that, keep going. Screw that, keep going. Please, Rachel, I'm saying screw that, keep going. Keep going with the queries. Querying right now is very difficult. People are getting very low responses, and it only takes one. And it often takes much more than 100 queries. So keep going. Do all of those 100. If you have no response from that 100, which would make it 182 queries, at that point, it may be a good point to start thinking about, do I want to self-publish this book? Do I want to hire another editor who will just, you know, maybe a really good copy editor, but you can ask them, I'm not sure about the developmental edit I got. Do you think I need more of a developmental edit? But, you know, you'll need a copy edit anyway, so hire somebody like that. And then you can start thinking about other things. But because I know you want to be traditionally published, then exhaust that 182 agents first. It is normal to not get any any requests for partials or fulls. You should be getting at least a couple requests for partials or fulls every once in a while, but it is normal not to get picked up by an agent. It is hard to get picked up by an agent, and it is okay to cast, it is appropriate and advisable to cast the net really super duper wide. To the next question you have about hybrid publishers, I believe that most hybrid publishers are vanity presses. They are just cloaked in a different way. You can Google Rachel Herron vanity, you know, Rachel Herron hybrid publishers. I did a whole episode on those. I can't remember what number it is, but it'll pop up. But I will quickly say here, hybrid publishers are in the business because they are making money from the author paying them. They are not in the business because they are selling books. They do not market and distribute the books for you. They put your book onto the exact same channels that you would put your book onto if you were self-publishing. And they don't know how to sell books because honestly, nobody knows how to sell books, not even traditional publishers. We're all just muddling along doing the best we can. People who go with hybrid publishers, for the most part, and there are exceptions every once in a while, do not sell many books at all. And I'm being really conservative. They do not sell books at all. So they never make money from that royalty from the hybrid publisher. Yes, instead of an 8% royalty that you would get at a traditional publisher, you might be getting 25 to 40% from a hybrid publisher. But that means nothing when you're not selling books and you've already given them $4,000 to have the right to have your intellectual property under their ISBN, and they make the bulk of the money. They're still making 60% of that, of the non-sale. They're not worried about not selling your books because they already got your money. I feel very strongly about that. And I feel like these are fighting words show. I didn't even come in here with an attitude. I just apparently have one today, and I'm not ready to put up with people who are hurting or injuring writers. And that's not okay with me. And I believe that most hybrid publishers are doing that. So that $1,600 to $4,000, I believe, if one decides to go into not traditional publishing, is better spent self-publishing, but hiring great help along the way. You do not need to take all the steps at once, and you don't need to spend a lot of money all at once to take every step. You will need to pay money to get your book professionally edited, which is the biggest cost, and to get a great cover. And then you can have somebody format it for you, which is inexpensive, or you can buy the formatting software, or you can use free formatting software. And then you can, for free, upload your book onto all of the vendors, including print and ebook and or including audio if you want that. I gave Rachel my publishing class, but if you want to look at that, I think it's still on sale at half off at rachelherron.com/publish. So please go look at that. This is a big, huge course where I break down how to do all of those steps. But the nice thing is you don't have to figure out how to do any of those steps until you get to it. Yes, it can be overwhelming the first time, but you do it step by step and you ask for help along the way. And it is normally quite a bit cheaper than going with a hybrid publisher. And then you have complete control. And if it goes mad, you're making 70% on a book you sell at Amazon. Amazon's only taking 30% and nobody's taking any other part of that. So going into the rest of Rachel's questions here regarding money. Number one, how were you able to financially produce a self-published book when you first started self-publishing? I need a copy editor, proofreader, cover artist, and book designer, and I have already invested in a developmental editor. I'm not sure when you did this publishing seminar, but the costs you mentioned are quite a bit lower than they are today, like everything else. The publishing seminar I only released earlier this year, so those are pretty recent numbers, but you have to be willing to look out and get price recommendations and quotes from everywhere. Rachel goes on to say, Readsy editors are charging anywhere from 0.3 to 0.5 cents per word, which puts my 85,000 word book at over 4K for copy editing. Readsy editors will quote that. But for copy editing, you're looking at usually under 2 cents a word, which is going to be around 14 to 1700. And you can even find cheaper. Here's a pro tip. This is how I found my copy editor, who is Canadian. And so the dollar goes farther there. But you can, this is, don't tell Readsy I said this. Somebody's going to tell Readsy. Sorry, Readsy. But you can go on to Readsy and find the find an editor that you like and say her name. I'm going to make this up. Her name is Sarah K. And because they only give the first name and last initial on Readsy, I've given this tip before, but I'll give it again. Sarah K is contracting through Readsy, which means she has to charge quite a bit more because Readsy is going to take some of that for her. She's a freelancer. Everybody on Readsy charges different prices because they're independent contractors. They're freelancing. They are setting their own rates. And Sarah Kay says that she used to be an acquiring editor at HarperCollins and Hachette. So then you Google Hachette editor Sarah and look for somebody who starts with K. There will be something on the internet that says who she is. Now you've got her first and her last name, and you go plug her into Google and you see if she has her own website. And then you go to her and she says, these are my editing services. And whoa, they are cheaper. So you can do that. It takes time to find both budget and good editors. And I know it's hard and it just takes time and reaching out to people on Facebook groups and asking who is great, who has really worked for you. And to your first question, sorry, I skipped over that one. How was I able to financially produce a self-published book? My first self-published books were after I was already traditionally published. So I was able to pull money from royalties of traditional publishing books and put it towards those first few self-published books. But I also had a leg up in that. And I will admit that my first three self-published books were books that were traditionally published in Australia and New Zealand. They were romances that were bought by HarperCollins Australia. So they were already professionally developmentally edited. I just had to get them copy edited to match American spelling. They produced the books in Australia and New Zealand and I self-published them everywhere else. So I put my toe in with that, first by being paid to write these books by a publisher, and then I self-published those books. So I didn't have to struggle to find that, and it would have been a large struggle to find that because for the first 10 years of my writing career, I was working two jobs, 80 hours at the 911 job and about 30 to 40 hours at the writing job for those 10 years. And we needed every scrap of that money because we were so far in debt. So that's the only way I was able to do that. It would have taken me longer to save up. But what I use is a program called, I have a lot of recommendations today. I use a program called YNAB, You Need a Budget, which changed my life financially. I can never say enough about it. It is not like normal budgeting software. It actually teaches you how money works. And the way I do it nowadays is if I want something that I can't afford, which is often right now, because we're still struggling a bit financially in the household, is I will set up a savings plan and I will put in a little bit of money every month, even if it's only $10. One of my for saving up for a new phone for both me and my partner, I have a $15 a month thing that I put in. And we only need a new phone every 2 or 3 years. And whenever I need a new phone, whenever one of our phones breaks, I go to that place in YNAB and I pull the money out because it's there, because I'm putting in a tiny little amount every month. And I would do that for self-publishing. That is what I recommend to people to do while you're writing this book, while you're writing the next book, while you're waiting to hear back. So while you're waiting to hear back from those 100 other agents, you're putting a tiny bit of money away towards the self-publishing fund for if you want to self-publish in the future, instead of pivoting and saying, oh, okay, I want to self-publish suddenly, we're always putting money away toward our career in whatever way that looks like. If then you are picked up by an agent and sold to an editor, great, you don't need to use that money and you'll use that to send yourself to a writing conference. And that is your last question. Do you attend any writing conferences / workshops? If so, would you recommend any? I recommend any writing conference. Keeping in mind that the bigger conferences, the ones that you've heard of, like Writer's Digest, that's the only one that's coming to mind right now. The bigger generalized conferences are going to skew very heavily still toward traditional publishing. And I just heard this from a group of students who came back from a publishing conference. They're still skewing towards traditional and perhaps raising their noses a little bit toward self-publishing, which I don't think is cool. But the genre conventions, Left Coast Crime and Thriller Fest, and if there's still a romance writers going on, those kind of genre conventions, ooh, they know where the money is and they know how to self-publish and they know how to do it well and they know how to do it indistinguishably from New York traditional publishing with products that is high that are as high quality or higher than what's being produced by New York. So I highly recommend the genre conferences. Go to the one that's closest to you. If you have a little writers conference in your own town, go to that one, because what you're doing is you're building community. You're meeting other writers. And that is one of the most important things that we can do for ourselves as writers, is to have friends that are close to us who will support us when we are frustrated with an editor or with a husband or with a wife or with a kid. We need those writers to go to and talk to about this stuff. So I really appreciate you asking these questions, Rachel. I believe in you. I believe in your book. Please keep going and get this book out there, just so you can tell your loving, beloved husband, I told you so. And Rachel told you so. Okay, that was very satisfying for me. And I hope I didn't piss you off, Rachel. I apologize. But that's not okay. All right, moving forward. Here's a question from lovely Brian, who says, let's see. I spent the past few months feeling a distinct lack of inspiration. I was able to focus on my full-time job, but not any writing side of things. Well, with spring comes great energy. So now I have energy and inspiration. And another Patreon question for you. It also relates to reading and learning and absorbing information. The short question is, how do I decide actually what to read or learn? Sorry that my questions aren't about craft or writing, really. I love them. I have so much right now. Things about successful business, background for the writing, fiction for fun and inspiration, fun nonfiction like the biography of the Gardener of Versailles, Black Friday 2023 course learnings, as well as podcast episodes galore. Ah, thank you, my friend. I look to you for the voice of how to organize my life right now. So Brian, I'm not sure if you've done the Clifton Strengths, but if you have, I'm guessing that your learner and your input are quite high. This is something that gives you energy. And with that kind of desire for knowledge comes some confusion sometimes on how we should organize it and how we should prioritize it. And I feel like there's a couple of ways to do this. As I'm looking at my window right now, a butterfly just flapped past, and I was literally going to say there is the butterfly method, which is what I utilize a lot personally with high learner and high input as well. I like to go towards my objects of attraction and what I am currently obsessed by and read a bunch about. And typically what I do is I get a bunch of books and I read, about half of each, and then I get caught up by the idea that this other book might have the idea. So then I start that book and I go, about halfway in, and then I get another book and I'm watching YouTube videos and I'm signing up for courses and then not taking them, or I take a little bit of it and then I got caught up by another course. And I just want to say really clearly, I don't think there's anything wrong with that method. I am always learning. I am always taking stuff in that is completely fascinating to me. And there is no moral superiority in finishing the book and writing down our best takeaways and the things that we have learned and the things that we will now implement into our lives. I always want to be the person that, you know, finishes the book and then implements it, and I become a better, stronger, more graceful, smarter, more organized, less procrastinating human being. And it doesn't happen. It could happen if I used a lot of discipline and willpower, neither of which I have in great amounts. And if I do have any, I'd prefer to spend them on my writing. So a lot of times when I am doing the learning thing, I am allowing myself to be a butterfly, just flitting here, flitting there, knowing that all of that is aggregating inside myself and I'm becoming a person with more knowledge, with more learning, with the stuff that really lights me up, that really gets me excited. And then if there is something that I desperately need to know more about, and I've done this, I'm just thinking just off the top of my head, when I wanted to experiment more with paid advertising of books, then I niche down hard. And that's when I'm probably still reading fiction and memoir on the side, but all of my nonfiction for a while will go to just marketing books, paid advertising books about marketing. That's when I will take a class and I will actually prioritize for at least 1 hour a week, usually on the weekends. I will watch that course and take notes and figure out the next action steps and figure out when and how I will implement them and then implement them. But at this point, I've made a decision. I've made a, what's the word? I've kind of made a commitment to myself that this is what I'm learning because I need to use it. And at that point, I do prioritize the thing I am committing to over all the other things that are shiny, and I stick to it. And that's when, and I do use this word prioritization seriously, that's when I will sit down with a list, usually by hand for whatever reason, I don't know why. And I write all the things that I could be learning from. And then I look at that list of 10 or 15 items and, you know, six are a book and three are a course. And then I start numbering them. This is the thing I think will give me the most benefit. That gets number one. What's the thing that will give me the second most benefit? And I'm guessing, of course, at what I think these things will give me, but that's number two. And then I ignore everything but number one. And when I am complete with number one, when I have sucked out all the information I can get from number one, I cross it off the list. I have all my notes usually in whatever file note-taking system I'm using at the time, which has been Notion for the last, I guess, 2 or 3 years. But I've been dabbling with Google Keep, which I should not do because Google keeps ripping apps out of my hands and now they're taking away podcasts, which just... I'm still not over Google Reader going away. But that said, then I'll go into number two and then I'll go to number three. And then usually I reach a point, I reach saturation where I realize I'm kind of seeing the same things over and over as I'm learning. And maybe it's time to allow myself to become a butterfly again. What do I want? What am I drawn to learning about next? So perhaps think about, what's the opposite of a butterfly? All I can think of is like a pinned butterfly, and we don't want to think about that. So allow yourself to be a butterfly and then allow yourself to focus when that feels right. But there's no right or wrong. There's no perfect way to do this. What has worked, and a really useful thing to ask yourself, what has worked for you in the past when you feel like you have been learning with joy and going back to those things? Because a lot of us forget about techniques that work really well. Hello, dog. That's Junebug. Thank you for asking. I always love your questions, Brian. All right. Here's where I admit that my friend Bill had a question a while ago and I didn't get to it in time. And he just published his book anyway. Isn't that amazing? So my friend Bill, his real name is William Apparent, has written a gorgeous, gorgeous book. And I could not be more proud of him. It's called A Life Half Told, Unraveling My Story Through DNA. And he and I met way back when, after he had found out through a DNA test that, you should buy the book, A Life Half Told, because you want to know this story. And this, it's a story of love. It's a story of finding true family love. And I am so proud of him for doing it. Bill, congratulations with all of my heart and all my love. I'm so proud of the work that you and your daughter did together on this book. And Bill had asked me, what do I need in the front and back matter? And I said, oh, that's a great question for the podcast. You mind if I answer it there? And then he said, not at all. And then he figured it out. And now the book is out there. But very quickly, for people who are wondering about that, if you are self-publishing your book and you're wondering what to put in the front and the back, I always like to think of what's the one thing, what's the one action I want a reader to take at the end of this book? Let's talk about just the back matter. At the end of the book, we only have a limited amount of time to grab the reader to do something, the time that they are most likely to push a button to click something is right after they finish your book and they're still in that warm, fuzzy place. If this is a series, you probably want them to buy the next book. So you may want to give them a sample chapter and all the clickability clicks. You know, here's how you get here's how you purchase that book. If this isn't part of a series and you're not really sure what the next book is going to be or how you might use them, you want to get them on your mailing list. Even if you feel like you're only going to write one book, you'll never write another book, please have a mailing list. Please have some way for people to sign up for it. You do not need to send them anything ever. Don't fall for that. That when people say you got to send them an email every month or every week, you don't. You can do what you want to do. But wouldn't it be nice if in 2 years you wake up in the middle of the night and say, oh, I'm going to write a new book and here's what it's about. That you've been quietly collecting the addresses of people who read your book and loved it and opted in to be told if and when you come out with another book. So that's usually the first or second most important thing that you want to ask them to do after they finish a book is either sign up your mailing list or buy the next book. What we don't want to do is something a lot of us are attracted to doing, which is tell them where your website is, tell them where your Instagram is and your Facebook and maybe your TikTok. And also you did this class over here and you could do this. That's too many clicks and people will opt out. They will close the book rather than having to decide between seven clicks. Give them decide what is the most important thing you want them to do and give them the one click. I will quickly say about front matter. It is useful to ask right at the beginning of a book, please sign up for my mailing list. I have tracked the clicks by using unique clicks in my books. People use that link. I would never sign up for somebody's mailing list if I hadn't read their book yet. I wouldn't. So my assumption when I first started doing this was don't put it there, even though I see people who do that. Don't put it there. But that's a really nice place for a one-click thing. Like it's the front page, the acknowledgement, or no, wait, it's front page. And then it says, if you'd like to sign up for my mailing list, click here. And then the acknowledgements page or the dedication page. And now we're in the book. I can tell by tracking people sign up for that link. So I put that in the front and then I try to have just one option in the back. I don't always succeed, but that's, I think, a really nice way to go. So Bill, again, congratulations. I'm so proud of you. All right, last question comes from Emily, who says, my question is actually two questions, but they are related. Upside down face. I love that one. I've decided to self-publish my cozy mystery series and I'm super excited. However, only the first book is ready to go. Book number two is drafted, but won't be ready for a while, like months from now. I just had a baby. Congratulations. I'd like to be able to have book number two available for pre-order when book number one is launched. But what if it's not done yet? Do I need to have the title and cover nailed down? What do I do? Secondly, I'm planning to have the books in the series be set at different times of the year and include Jewish holidays in them. Does that mean I need to try to publish each of them around that time of the year? If so, this could get pretty tough real fast. I'm not sure I can pump out a new book every 2 to 3 months. Anyway, thank you in advance for the help and all you do. You're welcome. Pumping out a new book every 2 to 3 months or so is incredibly difficult. Only a few people are able to do that. And with a new baby, I say don't give yourself that pressure. I'm going to start with that question since I'm already answering it. I love the idea of the books in the series being set around the Jewish holidays. I think that is so cool. And best practice would be to release that book about 6 to 8 weeks before the holiday itself. Second best practice is release it whenever the heck you want. And that's the way I normally do things, is just releasing is better than not releasing, right? Attempting to nail the exact perfect time to release is too much stress. Don't worry about it. If it happens, it happens. If it doesn't, then great. Next year, you can perhaps direct a little bit of advertising toward that book 4 to 6 weeks before the holiday. Anywhere between 4 and 8 weeks is a nice sweet spot before holidays. So I say, just do it. To your first question. So this is fantastic. When you launch book one, which could be anytime, basically what you do is, especially on Amazon, and I can't remember the pre-order rules for the other sites, but let's just talk about Amazon right now because that is the bulk of most of our sales. What is the pre-order? It used to be 6 months, but I think it might be a year. Hold on. I'll go check. Okay. Yes, it is 1 year before you want to have something up there, you can put up the pre-order. What that means is your first book goes up, and at the end of that book, the only thing you need to write for book number two is the first chapter, or the first however many pages you want, leaving them at some kind of tiny little cliffhanger that they must know the next thing that happens. And then you give them the pre-order link, which you have generated because over at Amazon, you have uploaded the book and the cover, except you don't have to upload the book or the cover. That's the nice thing. You can upload basically a blank document and a not done cover. It can be just a, is it a PNG or a PDF that they need? Can't remember. You'll see all of those instructions, but it could just say book number two and your name with no pictures. It could just be a solid color or white. You can make this in Microsoft Word. And you probably wouldn't want to, but it would take you 2 minutes to make something that can go up there as a placeholder. And then people are able to just click it and know that it will be delivered as soon as it is done. And you could choose anywhere for that pre-order to be all the way up to 1 year away. You can always release earlier if you want to. You can change the release date. It is a little bit dangerous if you just forgot that you had done that. Let's just say that you just forgot. You just forgot you did that. And in 1 year, anybody who has the pre-order will be delivered a blank Word document or a blank EPUB, and there will be no cover, and they will have paid for it, and they'll be mad. Don't do that. That is a danger, and it has happened. I don't think anybody's ever forgotten, but things have conspired against authors. They've gotten busy or they've had tragedies, and that's what happens. So that's not a good thing. Also, if you miss that pre-order, if for some reason you do not upload a full book and have the full package by the pre-order date, if you will be penalized. And I can't even remember the penalty. And you will not be able to have pre-orders on Amazon for 6 months to a year. I think it might be 6 months. But again, I'm having a hard time remembering these because they're always changing them. So what? So what? People act like that is the end of the world of, oh no, now I can't do pre-orders. Well, you know what? You tried a pre-order and it didn't work very well right then. Nobody needs a pre-order. So you're penalized and your next book can't have it for a little while. Who cares? So just do it. And then, you know, when you upload it on Amazon, you have the link. There you go. You put that into the places where you want to sell that book. And that's a really nice way to do it. So you don't have to have the book or the cover. You do want a really good sample chapter. Even if you haven't written the rest of the book, I have done that where you write the sample chapter and now you have to write the book around that. Or you can do what a lot of us do, which is write a sample chapter. And then when you realize later that that's actually not quite the book you were writing, the book that is delivered has quite a bit of a different opening. And you know who cares? No one. Readers are like, oh, she changed the book. Interesting. If they remember it all. So that is what I would recommend. And I think it's really exciting. And I do believe that in terms of motivation for writers, if you're a person who works well to deadline and you know that you will produce a book that you're proud of, that you then can put up for sale. Don't do this for your first book, please. It's because you haven't proven that to yourself yet. You need that kind of internal knowledge that you can do it. But having that up there is an incredible deadline. It is a scary deadline. And it's really, really a great one to work towards. So you've already proven to yourself that you can finish the book. So go ahead and do this with the second book. And guess what? You'll write the book. You will get that done around the baby, although I don't know how you mothers do it. So congrats on the new one. Thank you for this question. And I think that might be all the questions. It is. All right. Thanks. This was a nice, long, bonus episode, bumper crop. And if you would like to ask any of your questions, if I have confused you at all, or if you have an expansion of a question that you would like to ask me, please go over to patreon.com/Rachel and sign up and let me be that help for you. I really love doing it. And I am honored. Truly. I'm truly honored when y'all ask me to think about things and give my best guesses and my best answers, knowing that your way, the way that you end up doing it, will be the right way. No matter what I or anyone else says, the only thing that matters is that you keep writing and you keep moving forward. Please don't stop. Please don't wait for this weekend when you know in your heart of hearts that this weekend won't happen and you're really saying no to the book. Say yes to the book by doing just a little bit of work. That's all I ask you to do. And then come tell me about it. All right. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk soon. Thanks for joining me on this episode of Ink in Your Veins. You can reach me at my website, rachelherron.com, and you can also support me at patreon.com/Rachel, R-A-C-H-A-E-L, where I have all sorts of great stuff for writers for as little as $1 a month. And do sign up for my free writer's email list of encouragement at rachelherron.com/write. Now, get to writing, my friends.